Hello and welcome to Church Podmatics, a cheerful conversation about theology in a cheerless age. I'm Andrew Errington and I'm joined this evening with Matthew Mason. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Andrew. Good to be here.
And it's just us two this evening. Matt Wilcoxon couldn't make it, but it's good to be with you. Matt will be back, we're sure, next episode, but it's been a while between drinks, but we couldn't resist actually getting on with this great article. So this evening could be any time. So this evening for me in Australia, it's morning or midday for you.
It's pretty
Matthew.
Morning, yeah.
Today we're looking at a really great article by John Barclay in Studies in Christian Ethics just recently. The article's titled, Does the Gospel Require Self-Sacrifice? Paul and the Recognition of the Self. And I think it's just come out in the most recent edition, or this could be just still the online first one.
It has just come out, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so cutting edge stuff as usual here. Matthew, you're going to begin introducing this article, so over to you.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Well, it's a fascinating article written by a New Testament scholar who has obviously done a lot of work in recent years on gift and giving and grace, and who has thought hard about some of the philosophical questions and theological questions around that. So he offers a sort of theological and ethical reading of the letter to the Philippians and the theme of self-sacrifice. But he does that by setting it in the context of a history of altruism. And he says, my purpose is not to deny that self-sacrifice in some senses of that term may be an appropriate form of Christian love, but it's to ask about the larger moral and theological frame in which that idea of self-sacrifice is placed. So he's really wanting to challenge the idea that self-sacrifice and complete disinterestedness is the fundamental sort of note of Christian ethics and Christian living. And he does that, as I said, by a reading of the letter to the Philippians, but first offers a very brief thumbnail sketch of what he calls the road towards modern notions of altruism. So altruism just means concern for the other, but he says a distinctly modern perfection of the concept that he's calling exclusive altruism is that concern for the other, benefit for the other, is taken to exclude any benefit for the self, for myself. In the ancient world, actually, there wasn't that same sense. The fulfillment of the self included the welfare of others without zero-sum competition. He claims, I think probably rightly, that that's just common in ancient Greek ethics. It forms the world of early Christian ethics with some Christian modifications. But really, there is that sense that actually the heart of human relations are ideas of reciprocity and solidarity, and friendship is one of mutual benefit and joint fulfillment rather than me giving up everything for the sake of other people. And he sort of says this begins to go wrong in the modern era. And, you know, as is the wont of people, he begins to lay the blame at the feet of Martin Luther. Whether rightly or wrongly, I'm not convinced he's right on that, but then goes on into the 17th and 18th centuries, Thomas Hobbes, and then other later moral philosophers, and says in the 17th and 18th centuries, there's a noticeable emphasis on the polarity between disinterest and self-interest. And he argues this is what then plays into the way that we as Christians tend to think about love of others and altruism, that polarity between disinterest and self-interest. It's captured with Kant's desire to what he says, purge our motivations, so that actually we do good as individuals for the sake of others and only for their sake. And anything that smacks of self-interest is therefore morally suspect. He continues to track it through one or two other philosophers, but ends with Anders Nygren and his famous book, Agape and Eros. And says, look, in this book, self-seeking, desire-oriented and self-interested eros is put in the sharpest possible contrast with the self-emptying, wholly disinterested ethic of agape. And he says, look, you can see the attraction of that. with its radical heroic ethic and its strong critique of authoritarian leadership, that actually leadership is about self-emptying and disinterested service of others, but actually notices it could become quite patronizing and disempowering, it's so one way, and its idealization of self-negation could itself become a means of abuse. So that's how he frames the issue. This contrast between self-interest and disinterest, and he's going to critique that by a reading of Philippians. But I thought we could just pause for a moment, and Andrew, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it so far.
Yeah, two things that were really interesting to me about this survey, or maybe I'll first say I actually think it's a really, this kind of move to do a kind of brief intellectual history of an idea, you know, touring through the history of Western philosophy. I mean, you need a bit of chutzpah to do it, but actually this is a great example of it. You know, it's nicely done. There's a sense of balance. There's a sense of believability to the story, and you do feel like you're tracing ideas in a meaningful way. Two interesting things for me about this. The first were that he's actually sympathetic to, and I'm trying to kind of remember. Oh yeah, he's quite sympathetic in this to feminist critiques of this notion of altruism, and he comes back to this at the end as well. So he sees what he's doing as, in a way, at one with this, a feminist critique of this idea, and what this kind of positioning and this exclusive focus on the other and the neglect of self-interest, what that tends to do to and for women. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of this argument. The second is, he has this in his sights in terms of modern Christian thinkers, partly Michael Gorman's idea of cruciformity. And I think, you know, that's worth just noticing because it has been an influential and popular account. And he says on the page numbers might have changed in the print edition, but he says, Gorman's cruciformity stands within this distinctively modern trajectory. Although he draws upon orthodox notions of theosis, even these serve his thesis that kenotic servanthood and self-humbling are the essence of the Christian ethic. And that just leads to the bit that you just read. But I just think, did you read that bit about Gorman as well?
I
just think this is a really kind of, it makes it quite pointed, you know, and it makes you realize how much, you know, aspects of the church have been very much impacted by this intellectual story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I think I was interested with those things, but interested just by, I think they land slightly closer to home as well in terms of a lot of the way the Christian life was explained to me and the way I was discipled in it, the way Christian ministry was explained to me. Is very much about this kind of self-giving, disinterested, self-sacrificing service of others, which obviously has truth in it.
Yeah.
You know, that these things are not without a basis in the text of Scripture and reality.
I think we need to come back to that once we look at Philippians, but he ends up even endorsing, you know, the language of means later, and I'm almost endorses that, but we'll come back to that. But I agree, like, this is that it, what he's saying here very much does have pastoral implications, but I think it's not entirely straightforward how to kind of discover them, I reckon.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to comment on one other thing, which is in footnote 19. This is asked with great footnotes, by the way.
Yeah,
and I left going, there's a lot of books here I want to now go away and track down and spend a bit more time with, but also some just wonderful comments. And this is coming back to your feminism comment, actually, and drawing on the work of Sarah Coakley and her critique of kenosis. But I just was struck by this thing that he says here, ironically, the self-distancing that occurs in the negation of the self on behalf of the other strengthens the buffered individualism of liberal modernity. Giving for another can become a means to evade being with them. And that really hit home, that the sense that actually you can be the noble kind of one with power and something to give. But if it's not reciprocal, then what you do is you distance yourself from other people and therefore can evade being the inconvenient, messy and somewhat frightening at times, as well as joyful thing about being with them.
Yeah, and then the rest of that footnote, he says, I mean, I highlighted this footnote as well. He talks about how the idea of effective altruism is a kind of parallel phenomenon, because you get, in that you get a conscious disregard for pre-existent social ties, and it maximizes individual rational choice, perfecting altruism as a utilitarian calculus within a neoliberal economic frame. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a pretty, accurate but also searing critique of that whole kind of mode of, it's really interesting that altruism can give rise to this very highly individual and highly kind of, rarefied technological approach to ethics that's dismissive of any kind of natural affection and binding ties of loyalties and things. I think it's a great comment, that one. And it does make you think, yeah, there's probably something wrong with this.
Yeah, right. And I think that this little bit of our conversation, I think, shows this has real life implications for life within a Christian community, and for practices of ministry and attitudes and dispositions of ministry, but also the effective altruism stuff and the reference there to Peter Singer. This is not just an abstract theoretical academic debate. This is massively influential. Singer and effective altruism are hugely influential in billionaires, motivating them to, this is what is motivating them to give away vast amounts of their fortunes in this technocratic, individualistic, rationalistic desire to do good and maximize happiness in the world. So, yeah. Shall we move on to Philippians? Is there anything else you wanted to say, Andrew?
No, let's move on. I think if you can, ease up on the paper shuffling, just for the sake of our listeners. But that is a feature of this podcast, and I feel like without Matt Wilcoxon to control us, we may be
I will do my best.
So second half is about Philippians. Tell us what he says here.
Yeah. Well, he starts with Gorman's reading, and I think it's just worth framing that, the Christ hymn as the master story of Paul's theology, revealing that divinity has kenotic servanthood as its essential attribute. So this is important for just saying, this is what God is like. God is self-emptying love. This is the narrative shape of Jesus's life and ministry, humbling himself and becoming obedient to death. It is therefore the pattern for Paul's ministry within Philippians, for the ministries of Timothy and Epaphroditus, and then also to be the pattern for the Philippians' own lives. Look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. And Barclay just goes, okay, well, let's actually go through Philippians. Let's read it and let's see what it says about Christ, about Paul, and about the Philippians. And he says, yeah, these are all features in the text, the things that I have just said, but they need to be understood within a larger narrative and teleological framework. So the sort of fairly obvious point in one way, that actually the Christ hymn in Philippians 2 does not stop at the end of verse 8, but it goes on to the exaltation. So emptying then results in the exaltation of the Lord Jesus to the highest place. Paul's own life, he actually starts by saying the slightly odd thing, if you're thinking in exclusive altruism ways, that actually what he really wants is to die and to be with Christ, because that would be better for him. Given the choice, he would prefer for his own sake to die, whereas altruism would view risking death as a supreme self-sacrifice for the sake of others. Whereas actually Paul is saying, well, I don't want to die because I want to be with you to care for you, but actually death would be better for me. And he points to, I mean, this is a really quick and dirty kind of overview of what he's doing, but the use of sun compounds, which are all through the letter. Co-workers, co-soldiers. He ties his own pride and joy to that of the Philippians. Whatever they do offer to God, they offer together. So this idea of everything is with, I do this with, we do it together. So Barclay comments, whatever elements of self-giving are here at play, the goal is not that he loses and they gain, or that he gains and they lose, but that the pride, the joy, and the reward are conjoint and shared. And so he talks about the Philippians being co-sharers with me in grace in 1:7. The koinonia language, the joint participation language, is language of sharing and of common gain. Right at the end of the letter, when Paul receives the Philippians' gift, the gift giving takes place within a structure of reciprocity, extended over time and varied in expression. And Paul can cope with having little or having much in 4:12 and 13, but he does not regard fullness, having much, as an embarrassing contradiction. And actually, in regard to the Philippians' gift, although it is a sacrifice to God, he speaks of God as committed to filling your every need according to his wealth in glory in Jesus Christ. So actually what Paul idealizes is not emptiness, but fullness. And I think this is actually really important for taking us back to the doctrine of God and what kind of God we have and how God relates to us. He doesn't draw those connections, but, you know, I've been reading John Webster long enough to think that you have to. And then the last thing to say, The whole idea of looking not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. And I'd like to talk about how this works out in practice, Andrew. But he says, you know, this is actually a mutual reciprocal thing. It's not me doing that self-sacrificially for the sake of everyone else, but this is a community doing it for one another. So just to conclude this sort of introduction to this section, my introduction, that is, we might put it like this, he says on page 14. Here the self is reconfigured and redefined so that the competitive self, the self in contrast to others, is left behind, but the self in community, the self that is identified with the interests of others and they with it, is secured and enhanced as the community shares collaboratively in love, comfort, and mutual encouragement. So there's a relocation of the self, not over against other people, but in community with other people. And on page 16, I really like this. He says, the contrast, the polarity is not selfish versus selfless, but rather we should think about selfish versus self-with. Which I just thought was just a helpful way of framing it, that it is my life supposed to be a selfless life or a self-with others kind of life? I'll stop there.
Well, that's it's kind of a good point for me to jump in. I'll flag my question and my dissatisfaction with the article at this point, but then I'll say something positive. I do like this, you know, and it's nice. It's nice the way he sets up a problem, just says, look, Philippians just doesn't say this, you know. But I found where he gets to with that idea of self with a bit unsatisfactory because it just seems to me that there's not enough awareness of the, I mean, I'm sure he's aware, right? But in the article, there's not enough awareness of the kind of theological, ethical tradition of thinking about these things, right? So, you know, this is the question of self-love and the question of the place of self-love and the way in which self-love is kind of put to death but then actually regenerated within Christian ethics is you know, that's something there is a lot more on than is implied here. And the kind of the obvious absence in this article is of any reference to, you know, Augustine or that kind of tradition. You know, there is a reference to Oliver O'Donovan's book, Resurrection Moral Order, but it's just a passing reference. Mm-hmm. But, you know, O'Donovan's PhD in his first book was The Problem of Self-Love in St. Augustine. Yeah. And it's really wrestling with these exact themes, and with O'Donovan's book is in large part a long wrestle with the adequacy of Anders Nygren's framework. And as an alternative, he suggests Augustine's teleological framework. And so to kind of get to the end and propose a kind of category, self-with, for resolving these problems, I think is premature. I think the article is, it's fine to begin to point out the resources within Philippians, but I think we need, that's there's not, it needs to be put as, so here's a way of re-entering the tradition. You know, because there is more on this. That said, I think a lot of what he says in Philippians about Philippians is great. I was really surprised he didn't talk much about chapter 3, verses 12 to 14, where Paul talks about, you know, not that I've already obtained this or have already reached the goal, but I press on to make it my own because Christ Jesus has made me his own. Beloved, I do not consider that I have it, you know, forgetting what lies, I press on towards the goal for the heavenly prize, for the prize of the heavenly call of God in Christ Jesus. You know, there's a rich sense of seeking one's own best, Paul seeking his own best interest there. And I was waiting for him to talk more about that, and he didn't. And he didn't make much also of, he made a bit of this, and I may have underdone this, but he didn't make a heap of the way in which, so you get this language of not at your own interest, but also the interests of others in chapter, the beginning of chapter 2, but then just a bit later in chapter 2, verse 21, Paul says, all of them are seeking their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ, where he's talking about Timothy. And I think that reference to the interests of Jesus Christ is a really important kind of addition. And it just seems to me that there's the stuff he gets to with being with and the Christological kind of character of that. That for me is actually, and you mentioned this, that for me is the best bit of the article. Where is that? That's on page, it's kind of from page 12 and into page 13. You know, that the way in which our being with others is, it's right at the end. It's page 14 where he refers to Bonhoeffer. I think he's absolutely right to talk about, he does get to that verse on page 15 about Philippians 2:21, the interests of Jesus Christ. But that for me was, you know, that could have been developed and opened up a lot more.
Go on, do that for us now. Give us a little, you know, snapshot of what that might add, Andrew.
Well, okay, so let me, so there's one point early in the article. So this is really my reservation. There's a point early in the article where he says, in short, service, humility, and self-limitation are not ends in themselves nor self-standing ideals, but means to another end. Right? And what I don't like that move, because what it does is it leaves the structure of our self-interest intact, right? Whereas what I think the gospel does is to kind of radically reconfigure the whole structure of our self-interest so that it's not, so that we can't simply speak of self-sacrifice as means to an end, which is me getting what I wanted after all. It's that the reconfiguration of my desires is so kind of changed by the love of Jesus Christ that that kind of framework of means and ends gets messed up. And I think that's the That's, I think, what Augustine, you know, did with the category of self-love, is that he shows that self-love is preserved, but it looks radically different, you know, under the gospel to what it did. And I worry that there's not enough yet in this article about the way in which what happens to Jesus kind of reconfigures the whole structure of our desires for ourselves. I'm probably not articulating that well. Why don't you? What do you think of that? Is this unfair? What do you reckon?
It's interesting. I think you've read it more carefully than I have. Guess what? We were having.
Well, you have been finishing your thesis, so fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of reconfiguring our interests around the interests of Christ. You're right. It's mentioned in passing at the end. It's underdeveloped, and actually, it runs the risk of a fairly imminent understanding of the community, where it's just me and you. You know, I am the self with my brothers and sisters, rather than we are selves together with Christ, and under Christ,
yeah, and
oriented
I think that's
towards.
What happens. Sorry. I just think that's what happens in chapter 3 of Philippians, right? Which is that Paul, you know, he does lose himself in a sense, right? I regard it all as loss. For his sake, you know, I regard everything as loss because of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. Mm-hmm. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things in order that I may gain Christ.
There's a reconfiguration of what my own interest is at that point.
But I think it's deeper than that. I think it's not just a reconfiguration of what is good for me. It's as I discover what is good for me, my whole approach to kind of wanting and evaluating things is shifted by him. The language is not quite right, but what I do think Paul does here, I think he does more than – see, that sentence is early on, that one about means, right? It's on page 6, you know, where he describes – or page 6, I think, where he just – where is it? Hang on. Stay tuned. Page 9, where he describes, you know, service, humility, and self-limitation as means to another end. No, I don't think that's quite right. They are also – the way in which we come to know Christ. And so in a sense, they are the end in themselves.
Yeah.
And they're not the full attainment of that end, but they are already inhabiting the shape of that end. And that's where I'm not willing to be quite so down on Gorman, I think.
So here's a question then, which arises from a lecture I gave 2 or 3 weeks ago where I was talking a lot about sort of weakness and dependence in this life. And someone was sort of asking in the aftermath, what does that mean for the life of the world to come? And I think what you said is tracking with that kind of concern and saying, yeah, there's a reconfiguring. So it's not that there's this radical disjunction between my life now and my life when Christ returns, my life when I am raised. But actually that reconfiguring of love and the interests of others is just what the life of eternity will be like. But so I think what I'm trying to figure out is what's the difference? What changes? Like there's a deep transformation that goes on between verse 8 of Philippians 2 and verse 9 of Philippians 2, where, you know, God has exalted him to the highest place and given him the name that is above every name. Where there's a transformation and yet it stays the same, where his identity as the Son of God is reaffirmed, but now he is raised as a man and exalted to the highest place, which is the place that rightly belongs to him. But it's not that he suddenly starts behaving in a way that's radically different from the way he behaved in his state of humiliation. He's just not suffering and dying for the sins of the world anymore. And so I'm trying to, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Okay, how is there continuity in the identity, character, and behavior of Christ? And then how is there continuity between my redeemed self now and my redeemed self in the world to come? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, it does. And I think, you know, at one level, I'm totally with Barclay here, because at one level he just wants to make the argument that a total denial of self, right, and a total denial of our own interests simply just is not Christian ethics, right? But Jesus said, and this was Augustine's kind of, you know, go-to text, you know, whoever loves his life will lose it. Mm-hmm. Whoever loses his life for my sake and the sake of the gospel, said Jesus, will find it. You know, and so there's an inbuilt assumption of love, of care for oneself,
yeah,
and a right regard for one's good. It's the same in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That implies a kind of, you don't even need to use the word legitimate. It's an ineliminable, unavoidable, yes. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Concern for the self, and that Barclay's totally with a lot of the tradition there when he says to try and get rid of that is to radically kind of distort, you know, these calls. And I'm with him 100% on that, and I do think he's right that there has been this sustained attempt in Western kind of philosophical ethics to, you know, throw mud at any concern for self, and I think that is destructive. But I do think the love of self, the right love of self, has to be able to encompass the kind of loss of self in the light of Christ,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the way in which I can be willing to lose everything in order to gain Christ, and the way in which that kind of radically, at least radically, chastens self-love, and disciplines it. And cuts quite a lot out of it. You know, I think it's a radical surgery that's performed.
Yeah, and, well, it's crucifixion, isn't it? In Galatians, I've been crucified with Christ.
Which, that's kind of what Gorman's getting at, isn't it? Mm. I mean, so that just makes me wonder whether the, you know, whether he's quite successful in arguing against all of that.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's good. That's given me a lot to think about. I would love to go. Go on.
Oh no, I do think, just to come back to your pastoral point, right?
Yeah.
Like, I do think it's important not to give people the impression that all there is to Christian ethics is a kind of ethic of self-sacrifice.
Yes.
Actually, that's a kind of, what, because pastorally what that mostly amounts to is actually just an ignoring and lack of knowledge of yourself. And that doesn't actually lead to not caring about yourself. It leads to a kind of ignorant concern for yourself and a thoughtlessness about your own self in relationships. Much better actually to have a kind of aware, conscious sense of yourself and your unavoidable commitment to it, I think.
That's great. And I think as well, you're right, it does become an ignorant, unself-aware sense of self. And I think it becomes, on the other side of that, I want to say unconsciously and unintentionally, a tool of manipulation of other people.
Yeah,
to get them actually, for the sake of disinterested self-sacrifice, to get them to do the things you want them to do. which I think can have, again, I think often unintentionally, quite sinister undertones.
And that's really kind of close to some of the things he says at the end. So right at the end, the conclusion is quite strong, I think. But right at the end, he's, or, like this is page 16 in mine, as suggested by my brief historical survey, there is a large inbuilt bias to be overcome here in the modern moral imagination of the West. But what I'm arguing stands in accord with a feminist challenge to an ethic of self-negation, which has typically caused harm disproportionately to women, just as it chimes with a proper Christian questioning of a one-sided ethic of sacrifice or suffering and an undialectical kenotic Christology. I mean, I think I'm fully in support of him in the need to have a dialectical kenotic Christology, and which is what you were pushing for before, right? That you know, Christ doesn't just die. He's raised and exalted, and that is part of the story. But I, you know, and I think that kind of uncomplicated ethic of self-negation, I'm glad he's put a target on it and said, come on, you know, it's not even in the key text.
right, only if you stop reading.
Yeah,
and you stop reading halfway through the key text. Yeah, so it's from his fullness we have received, isn't it? Not from his emptiness we have received. So he pours out his fullness for us without ever ceasing to be full. And maybe that's another way of talking about what, in the end, what is my self-interest? It is knowing Christ and knowing fullness in Christ. So the end of Ephesians. That's John 1. The end of Ephesians 1. That we may be filled with all his fullness. Well, that's Ephesians 1, Ephesians 3, the prayer as well, that there is that sense, but it's his fullness that fills us. We should stop, but I would love just to have 2 minutes from you as a pastor about, you know, there's a large inbuilt bias to be overcome here in the modern moral imagination of the West. And Andrew, I think you've really helpfully flagged the way that John Barclay gets us a significant way towards doing that, but misses some important things. How, as a pastor, are you trying to help your congregation and yourself and your family overcome that bias that we have?
Look, I actually think this, I actually agree with Barclay here entirely. And I think, like, even though I'm not entirely with him on the argument, but at the need to kind of unpack this a bit is very important. And because I think one of the things we need to learn in the life of a congregation and Christian community is that in order to love, you actually don't love somebody well if you don't kind of hold yourself together. Right, if all you're doing is giving yourself away and failing to kind of keep your integrity as a self, you actually fail them in the long run. Real love is a giving of oneself, but there needs to be a self to give. I think you see this in all sorts of moments in the New Testament, but one of my favourites is, you know, at the end of Galatians, Paul says, bear one another's burdens, for in this way you'll fulfil the law of Christ. But then literally like two verses later, he says, but take care lest you are not tempted. Each one must carry his own load. And you get this Paul there balancing this sense of bearing another's burdens but each carrying his own load. And this need to kind of, you know, to be slightly careful with your integrity as a whole within a system of relationships. And I actually think that way of, one of the things this kind of material can do with its essentially affirmation of the self, right, and the the legitimacy of thinking about yourself and your own good, and of the kind of I language that Paul says, I want Christ, you know, and I that goal for me is precious to me, and I'm allowed to kind of have and articulate that goal. The kind of affirming the legitimacy of that kind of thought actually helps kind of secure a sense of self, so that it's harder for others to abuse that and take advantage of it, and it's harder for me just to become diffused in activities of service. And so I think this is stuff that comes up for me all the time. It's the reason I sometimes ask people, you know, to pull back a bit from doing too much, or I'm not always good at doing that, but I try to do that. It often comes up in talking to people about their relationships as well. But you're a pastor for a long time. What do you think about this? What do you think about what I just said?
I was resonating with all of it, I think. I real love is a giving of the self, but there needs to be a self to give. It's just a huge thing, I think. I was with a group of friends recently.
I'm going to put that on a greeting card, actually. So
I think. Yeah. Well, I think it needs to be on your Twitter bio, actually.
Sorry, you're with a group of friends.
In fact, volume one of the Errington memoirs, Real Love is a Giving of the Self, volume two, there needs to be a self to give.
Yeah, that'll be short memoirs, but yeah. You're with some friends.
Well, write them before you go senile. You'll be fine. I was with some friends, and it was just a delightful group of people, all of whom are slightly off-center in different ways, in lovely ways, just lovely
Unlike
ways.
Unlike you, yeah.
But that was the thing. This is where I'm getting to the point of the story. I was struck by how comfortable everybody was with their own skin, in their own skin, and how well that worked together. And how enriching it was. And I realized I am a bit off center and a bit weird. And I was at school and I was really comfortable with it. I was just myself and I was quite happy with that. And I became a Christian and it all changed. And I lost bits of me and I downplayed bits of me, you know, for good and ill. But what I ended up with was there wasn't a lot of a self to give. And it was all rationalized in terms of sacrificial self-giving. And I think allowing people to be aware of themselves and be comfortable with themselves, but knowing how to bring that into love for Christ, conformity to Christ, wanting him and seeking his interests, seems to me in some ways that sort of the art of pastoral ministry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think the pastoral ministry can put huge pressures on this. You know, when you're just spending a lot of time with others, kind of seeking to help others move forward in their journey of faith, and when it's just consuming a lot of your life, and especially if, like me, you live at the church, your family are there, church things are in your hand, you know, it's a sense of a loss of my kind of wholeness and integrity as a person is always a danger. And I think it's one of the I think it's one of the reasons for burnout and kind of people making terrible mistakes in ministry.
Yeah, yeah.
So thank you, Mr. Professor Barclay, for telling us that would be stupid. Yeah, and that we're just following kind of John Stuart Mill and Immanuel Kant if we do that. So that was, you know, that's a good reminder.
It's a good reminder. It's a really good article. You can find it online at Studies in Christian Ethics. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's an easy read as well. He writes with great simplicity and clarity. So even those of our listeners who might not spend lots of time wanting to read academic journal articles, this one actually is accessible and readable, and I think well worth a read. Andrew, thank you. This has been really fun and stimulating. We are looking forward to the return of Dr. Wilcoxon.
Oh, I think I just lost Matthew Mason. Well, anyway, this is that's the news from Lake Wobegon. Have a great time, everybody.